Probably don't need the microphone, but...
Yeah, the microphone.
Yeah, make sure we're on that. Good morning and welcome to... This is The Good War, American Mormons' Views of World War II with Jesse Embry and Michael Van Wagenen. We'd just like to welcome you all here on this... It's bright and early for me. I know it's not normally that bright and early, but today it's bright and early. Saturday it's bright and early. Give a little brief introduction of the presenter and the commenter. Jesse Embry works as director of the Oral History Program at Charles Redd Center for Western Studies at BYU and is an instructor of history there and wrote Mormon Polygamous Families, Life and the Principle. She's currently working on a book on LDS African Americans, directing oral history projects on LDS ethnic groups and sister missionaries and missionaries who traveled without purse or script. This research she's done in World War II as part of an oral history project the Redd Center conducted during the last year on the home front in the Intermountain West. Also, Michael Van Wagenen worked as an interviewer for that project. And as a postscript, this is for her an attempt also to do family history on the job, since the letters that were used were written by her grandmother Embry and her parents and her father's siblings during World War II, so worked out real well. Michael Van Wagenen is writer and producer of Utah on the Homefront, director-producer of Attack on Fort Stevens, and director and producer of Invasion USA, Japanese Attacks on Mainland America. So these are colorful folks, and I'll just turn the time over to them.
Since the founding of the Mormon Church, Latter-day Saints have looked for the second coming of the Savior, and they viewed the Civil War as the beginning of that war wars that would be the beginning of the end. But every war since then has not been viewed in exactly that same light. So what I want to talk about today is how did Americans view World War II? It's the 50th anniversary of the United States' entrance into that war. Just exactly how did American Mormons view the World War II? There have been two studies that have looked at Americans' views of war overall. One of them was a master's thesis, which was done by Jeff Stout, who was there at the same time I was there as a graduate student. He looked at Mormons' views of seven different wars, and he said after World War I, Americans stopped looking for a just war, that war after that was simply like taking out the garbage, it had to be done. And he quotes a 1942 statement that was issued by the First Presidency concerning World War II. The statement was essentially written by J. Reuben Clark, which declared war as a means of being able to settle international disputes, and pointed out, though, that Mormons were citizens of countries and therefore should defend their countries. Patriotism, therefore, became a justification for war. Stout contends that although the Mormons were encouraged to support their own individual government, that the church leaders mainly talked about America, that the church was small enough during World War II and was basically American, therefore that could therefore refer to you're patriotic and you support America. In an article published in Sunstone in 1982, Ronald W. Walker used the same 1942 statement and other First President comments to claim that by renouncing war and rendering to each competing Caesar his military due, the religious movement departed from the narrow nationalism of its birth. What's interesting is that neither Stout nor Walker saw World War II as that war to end all wars, but they came to opposite conclusions about the effects of World War II on the American people. Was World War II a war that focused on the United States, or was it one where the church became an international church? What's interesting is if you read the talks by general authorities, you can get both points of view. And that's how both of them can come to that conclusion. Now, this paper is based on church periodicals and is on some oral histories that have been done by the Redd Center, as mentioned, and by my grandmother's letters. And, of course, given those sources, it's not the final word on the American Mormons' views of the war. In fact, when I told my sister that I was quoting my grandmother as a typical Mormon, my sister assured me my grandmother was going to come back to haunt me because she didn't want to be typical. She tried to be unusual her entire life. So, but whatever, I think that the kinds of information I'm going to discuss will lead to some interesting discussions about how Americans and how Mormons viewed World War II. So how could Stout and Walker come up with such different responses of how the First Presidency viewed the war? The answer is very simple. J. Reuben Clark and David O. McKay, who were the counselors to Heber J. Grant, made statements on both sides of the statement. Clark was a pacifist who opposed war. And in October 1942, he said that we condemn the current war that we're involved in because it's either communism on one side or fascism or Nazism on the other side. And each of these systems destroys liberty, wipes out free agency, stifles freedom of speech, and crushes out freedom of religion. David O. McKay also spoke about the evils of war, and in April 1942, he declared the war as the opposite of the gospel of Jesus Christ, but added, in the face of all this, I should seem inconsistent when I declare that I uphold our country in the gigantic task it has assumed in the present war conflict, and sustain the church in loyal support of the government in fighting against dictatorship. Other general authorities, according to Ronald Walker, also exceeded the narrow and official statements of the presidency. They talked about the destiny of America, and there's a number of statements where the statements point out that the government is smiling on, that God is smiling on the United States because of it being a righteous country. Albert E. Bowen, for example, talked about America and said, "We must likewise sustain our country in the full measure of the requirement of loyalty. The nation is now at war. We dare not lose that war, for its loss would mean the loss of the liberties that we have come to esteem." So given these rather conflicting views of the war, how did Mormons just in general view the World War II? My atypical grandmother, Iola Harriet Byrd Embry, spoke out quite openly about her opposition of war. In letters to her son Ralph, who was serving in the Northwestern States Mission, she explained her philosophy of war. On the 8th of December, 1841, just one day after Pearl Harbor, my grandmother wrote to Ralph and urged him to stay on his mission, even though the United States was now at war. Apparently, when Ralph had initially left for his mission, he said that he would return if the U.S. entered the war. Grandma pleaded, "I beg of you, my son, not to do this until you are called. That will be soon enough if you are needed. In the meantime, you are very much needed where you are. This is not going to be a short war, nor will it be fought like the last one, World War I, where everyone went hurrying to get into it and almost everyone went into it unprepared." She added that one of the best things that people could do is just go about their work and see that everything little that we can be done is done. This is especially true of teaching the gospel. She continued to encourage Ralph to stay on his mission, explaining, "You are engaged in a work just as important as any work in the world. You can get in the army at any time and will be there for a long, long time. So it's not going to hurt you to do something for the Savior for a little while." Yet at the same time that my grandmother encouraged Ralph to stay on his mission, she also agreed that the war needed to be fought to preserve the liberties found in the United States. She recalled a June conference address by J. Reuben Clark where he said that it was his earnest prayer, and this is my grandmother quoting what she remembered, it was his earnest prayer that the Latter-day Saints would be the 10 people that would save our country and our world from complete destruction as 10 people would have saved Sodom and Gomorrah. While Ralph was now teaching the gospel, she felt that he would have plenty of opportunities to fight. It was more important to plan for a lasting peace. And she didn't want Ralph to, quote, "get the idea I'm not patriotic and I don't want you to go fight because I'm afraid that you're going to die. That is not true, and there are many things much worse than death to me." Well, just as my grandmother felt a need to support her country, Latter-day Saint Americans were patriotic, and they showed that support by their actions. Patriotism could be honoring the flag, it could be having parades and bands to set off soldiers, it could be prayers for the end of the war and prayers for peace. We did some interviews at the Red Center where we interviewed Swiss and German immigrants to Logan, Utah, and one of them, Willie Smith, said that he felt no divided loyalties. When asked in an oral history interview how he felt about the war, he explained, "My feeling was, I am an American citizen." Some of the actions of Mormon leaders and members were mandatory because there was rationing on gas, oil, and tires, so it was impossible to travel. At least it was supposed to be impossible to travel. Yet despite these rationing problems, somehow my grandmother kept going back to the South to do her beloved genealogy, and then she went back east to visit her family. My grandfather went to Tennessee to visit his father, who was dying, and he went to New England to visit my Uncle Alvin. My parents went back and across the country several times, not simply because their white father was involved in the military, but for a variety of other reasons. My aunts, Elsie and Leora, both went back east to visit. At one point, my grandmother even writes in her letter, "All this traveling might seem somewhat unpatriotic." But since my grandparents and my family could travel so much, it seems that it wasn't really necessary that the LDS Church cut back on its general conference and only allow 500 priesthood members to attend. I was reading some of the minutes for the RLDS Church, and they just had their conference every 2 years, despite the fact that the war was going on. So the fact that the church was willing to cut back on its general conference seems to me a case of patriotism rather than simply that they were restricted and it was impossible to travel. They were encouraging the people not to travel. Patriotism was expressed in a number of variety of ways. Mormons, of course, fought in the war. They were involved in defense-related industries. They bought war bonds. Even the church bought $17 million worth of government bonds. Individual members were also encouraged to buy bonds, and occasionally a general authority would talk about the need to buy bonds. My family was also very active in buying bonds. In fact, in one letter that my mother wrote, she said, "Maybe we won't send you any Christmas presents or any birthday presents this year, we'll just send you bonds." Lori Robinson, who was a child living in Wyoming during the war, recalled that she had raised a horse from just a very small colt, and she sold that horse, even though she dearly loved it, so that she could get some money, so that she could donate it to her school, so that her class could win the war bond drive that they were having. And even now, this many years later, when she talks about that horse, she's very sad that she sold it. But she did it as a big part for the war effort. Richard Van Wagner's grandfather gave them bonds as Christmas gifts throughout the war. And other interviewees remember having money withdrawn from their checks so that they could purchase bonds. And those who didn't buy bonds said, "Well, we didn't make enough money, but we wish we could have helped in the war effort in that way." I read through the Cash Stake manuscript history, and there's very little mention of the war. But in the Benson War, that's an exception. And they talked particularly about how in Benson they were pushing for the 7th War Bond. And the Benson Ward, which at that time was the whole town of Benson, allotment for the war was $29,500. And the manuscript history said that would come out to $300 per family. And people weren't giving their money, and so they were really concerned they weren't going to meet their goals. But the manuscript history replied that we did finally make the goal, and Benson Ward stayed true to form. My grandparents lived in the Logan 10th Ward, which was in the Cash Stake at that time. And there are very few mentions of the war during sacrament meeting, though occasionally the bishop would ask the members of the ward to pray for the boys and girls who was in the service. When a serviceman or a servicewoman would come back on furlough or immediately after the war, they were called on to speak in sacrament meeting. But there are very few talks about the war itself, although there are occasionally talks about the virtues of the American Constitution and the need to support the war bond drives. In addition to war bonds, Americans were encouraged to grow victory gardens and to conserve all essential wartime materials. So the Relief Society magazine carried a number of articles about the advantages of having gardens, not just vegetable gardens, but also flower gardens. According to one article, flower gardens bring us closer to nature and build morale. Every sturdy marigold, zillia, and petunia will lighten the heart of the gardener as well as those who look at it. Hazel D. Moyle wrote in an article about gardens that the 1943 home garden will play an important role in our country's mighty program of peace. For gardeners, too, have been called to arms. It's just that our weapons will be the digging fork in the hoe. Every row of carrots or tomatoes that we can raise and use at our family tables will mean just that much more food for our boys on the fighting front. This article appeared in February 1942, and the Relief Society continued to run articles. Most of them were practical articles about how to plant a garden. Now, my parents, who are now alone and continue to grow a garden far bigger than you need for two people, planted gardens wherever they were throughout the war. My father worked in St. Louis for a while when the war started, and then he moved to Berkeley, California, where he worked for what turned out to be the Manhattan Project. He then joined the Navy, and they traveled throughout the United States while my father received his training. And every time they went, they found a little plot of ground, and they planted a garden, and they might move on before they were able to harvest their garden, but gardening was extremely important, and I don't know whether they had nothing else to write about or they truly felt gardens were that important, but that is a frequent discussion in all the letters that they ever wrote home to my father's parents. Supporting war also meant being in the military or being in defense-related industry. After my Uncle Ralph completed his mission in 1943, he joined the Army. And my father, who was about to be drafted, and instead of trying to get a defense-related deferment, which he probably could have since he was working on the Manhattan Project, elected to join the Navy where he could be an officer. My Uncle Alvin worked for General Electric, and his job was considered to be essential for the war. During most of the war, my Aunt Elsie attended Utah State Agricultural College and complained about not having any dates. She was most dismayed that she graduated a, quote, old maid, but she decided to join the WAVES rather than go on the mission that my grandmother wanted her to go on and rather than taking a teaching contract. For those who did not join the military, there were always defense-related jobs. However, there were articles in the Relief Society magazine that encouraged mothers with young children at home not to join the military, or I mean not to go take defense-related jobs. And the federal government also encouraged that. And so with this type of encouragement, Phyllis Barker Van Wagenen, our distinguished commentator's grandmother, elected to stay home at home with her children, reasoning, with three small children at home, I felt it was important taking good care of them and trying to keep my husband, who had been drafted, encouraged so he would not worry too much about the situation at home. And the Relief Society magazine carried articles that supported this. For example, the title of one was Preserving the Child's Family Life in Wartime. But for those women who did not have small children at home, being a part of the war effort, taking defense-related jobs was very much a part of their patriotic duty. My mother followed my father around to all these different places with his work and then with his military assignments, and she really wanted to be a part of the war effort. My mother is a trained nurse, and so usually as soon as they got to a place, she would go to the local hospital and she would say, I'm here, and they would hire her on the spot. When they were in Berkeley, my father was and my mother were both on shift work, and they usually just passed each other in the apartment. They were not there at the same time. And so then my mother decided to quit, and my father wrote to his parents, maybe some folks would say that it isn't patriotic, but then again, it may be a matter of opinion. After all, we may not have much longer together before there would be a long period of separation. My grandparents even got involved in the war effort. With the rationing of gas and tires, it was difficult for my grandfather to carry on his independent trucking business. And although he always preferred to be his own boss, he helped to build Bushnell Hospital in Brigham City, and he worked in the defense depot in Ogden. In one of his very rare letters, I mean, my grandfather did not write letters, and he wrote them in pencil, and they're very hard to read. He wrote to Ralph, I am away for 13 hours each day. I come every morning at 10 after 6, get home around 7:20 at night, 6 days a week. So he was commuting from Logan down to Ogden. My grandmother even made that commute and worked as a typist. She wrote to Ralph on the 18th of December, 1942, quote, well, salute your mom. I'm helping to lick the Japs. I pound a typewriter all day long, for which they are paying me, I suppose. I've done it for so long without pay that it does not seem possible that they could be paying me for something which I like to do so well. She liked to type, but she was an awful typist, by the way. We laugh and say, they paid her to type? Later, she worked in the kitchen at the Utah State Agricultural College, washing dishes used by the military men who were in training there. She explained her work, I suppose it sounds rather silly to say it, but I feel like I am needed up there, and they're nice enough to say so. She said she also enjoyed having the extra money, but added, "I would do it for nothing. If necessary, however, even though most everyone laughs at patriotism, and there's this kind of talk of people laughing at patriotism, but I don't find people actually doing that. Even though most everyone laughs at patriotism, yet to me it was a real, living, vital feeling, and I'm not ashamed of it either. Even though it is washing dishes, it is needed, and I can do it. And the greatest lesson that Jesus taught, it seems to me, that a humble station in life usually brings more real happiness." Ethel W. Graham, who grew up in Union and then moved to Salt Lake City just before the war, recalled, "Everyone was war conscious, and of course, there were so many of the boys being drafted and sent away, and so many people that weren't being drafted that went away to work in the arms plants. Her view was that everyone who wasn't in the service worked in these arms plants. While that's not true, a number of the people interviewed for the Charles Red Center Homefront Project did work at the Remington arms plants, and they also worked at Fort Douglas or at the military installations in Ogden. But being involved in the war effort didn't mean that you had to go out and fight, actually. It also could mean knitting stockings or making quilts. During World War I and World War II, the Relief Society had been very involved in Red Cross work. But in 1940, the Relief Society had issued a statement which called upon individuals to do church welfare projects before they did Red Cross sewing. However, with the start of the war, the January 1942 Relief Society magazine reversed that policy, quote, "Now that the United States is actually at war, the General Board recommends that Red Cross sewing be done in the regular monthly work meetings, in addition to the church welfare program." So that one of the people that we interviewed in North Logan talked about how at their work meetings in Relief Society, they always had three or four quilts on quilting frames, and when they were finished with the quilts, they bundled them up and sent them off to the war effort. A woman from Salem, Utah, recalled that they received Red Cross yardage, and then it was taken out to the women, and they would do sewing, not only quilts, but also making afghans and house shoes for soldiers who were in hospitals. Everyone made sacrifices for the war, and those sacrifices varied from women, because they couldn't get silk stockings, wanted to have a look that they had silk stockings on, and so they would use makeup to paint a line up the leg so it looked like they had stockings on. To children who went without bubble gum, and that might not seem such a great sacrifice, but for a child it would be, to playing with wooden toys because there was no metal to make toys out of, to going without their favorite foods. Now, you have to really understand how much my mother loves raisins. She eats them every day to understand this quote. My grandmother wrote, "I saw a package of raisins marked 78 points. Only a polygamist with a dozen small children would be able to raise that and continue to live out of a paper bag." Whether spoken or in action, the message of the church leaders and the response of the Mormon members was that the United States needed to win the war. During the war, the church was relatively small and members were mainly in the United States. General authorities could speak of patriotism and only refer to the United States. And most Americans supported the war because they believed in the Constitution and the American way of life. When the end of the war came, people celebrated in the streets. Yet the official policy of the church was simply to pray for peace. Just before the war ended, the First Presidency issued a statement asking bishops to have a V-Day prayers in their regular sacrament meetings. "The prayers and the remarks should express to our Heavenly Father gratitude that the terrible bloodshed in Europe has ceased, thank Him for our Constitution and for the Republic, and petition Him to cause the spirit of peace to enter the hearts of hearts and to bring about the treaties of peace that can be drawn in such a way that will forestall the possibility of war in the future." Throughout World War II, and even at the closing days, the church did not look at the war as a chance for a continuing war towards the last day, but as a chance when the war ended there could be a lasting peace. There was very little talk that this war might be part of the wars and rumors of wars that Joseph Smith had reported. These ideas were occasionally mentioned, but it was rare enough that even for my father it was a shock. And my father right now is continually looking for the last days, by the way. He wrote home after going to a missionary conference in St. Louis in 1942 when he was working for REA. He recalled during the afternoon session, quote, "I've never been to a church meeting where anyone made such strong statements as the mission president, Bowman, did in that session." He, of course, based what he said on prophecy, and some of it was his opinion. He said the Allies would almost suffer defeat, but then they would repent, and call upon help, and the last minute they would get it. After giving an account of the talk, though, my father added, "I think it's all right for a person to have those kinds of ideas and even tell other people about them, but I don't think such ideas should be given at a conference of the church." He then asked, "Maybe they are general views and are being preached all over. Let me know if you hear of such preachment there." Well, my grandmother reported my father's letter to my Uncle Ralph and then told of a Mrs. Parson who said that a Mr. Tracy had said that at a meeting that he had attended that they had talked about the fact that this was the winding up scene. John A. Witzel was the only general authority who addressed this topic in conference, and his response was similar. It was simply that no one knew when the second coming was going to be. He said, "Questions and speculations are rife among the people. Some ask, is this Armageddon? Others said, will the Savior come when this is over? And there are those who look at the prophecies and try to say, these are fulfillment of prophecy. To all of such questions, there is but one answer. We only know that this is the dispensation of the fullness of times, the Saturday evening of the earth's temporal existence. There's no benefit in prying beyond the revealed word of the Lord." World War II was probably the last worldwide conflict where the church memberships was largely American. This does not mean that in another conflict that the church leaders might not support the United States because Mormons have always pointed out that America is a very special nation. Yet with members throughout the world now, the church will have to decide how to deal with the question of right and wrong in war. When the Iron Curtain came down, a friend of mine commented that Russia and the Allies could not crumble because they were the enemy, and they were the people we've always believed were going to cause World War III. And with the Gulf War, I heard people say, well, the last days are supposed to take place in the Middle East, therefore this must be the end because that's where these problems are taking place. What will the future bring? Obviously, John A. Witzel's statement still applies. No one knows when the final winding up will come. Yet World War II was not seen as part of that conflict. Rather, it was a patriotic war against evil. It was for Ethel W. Graham, one of our interviewees, and other Mormons, as it was for most Americans, a war that had to be fought. Thank you.
During my last year at Brigham Young University, I did work for the Charles Redd Center for Western Studies, and specifically I was assigned to the World War II Rocky Mountain Homefront Oral History Project, where I was an interviewer, and I worked under the supervision of Jessie Embry. And so I was quite excited to see that she had taken some of the initial interviews that were done and written this paper. And I really believe it's a strong paper, as well as being informative and quite accurate in its conclusions. The Good War sets out to basically prove two points or discuss two topics. First of all, was World War II seen by church authorities and the members as the winding up scene leading up into Armageddon? Jesse used really effective quotes from church authorities showing that it really wasn't a common belief amongst the church, or at least preached. But most effective, I thought, was her use of her father's experience, which I found to be quite typical in the number of interviews that I've done, where it was really not something that was on the minds of the church members at the time, but it was rather they considered the war something that had to be done and not something that was leading directly into Armageddon. And so I believe that that was quite accurate. The second part of the paper was dedicated into looking into a general experience of World War II. And as Jesse pointed out, it's sort of hard to discuss the LDS community as being typical or any experience necessary in it being typical. But I think due to the nature of the Second World War and the emotional impact of the tribulation and the unifying effect that had on the LDS community in America, you can really find a consensus there. And as Jesse pointed out, the interviews that were done are certainly not the final word on the home front experience. However, through the interviews that Jesse used, and especially, I thought especially effective were the letters from her relatives, because sometimes their oral interviews have a tendency to get colored over the years, but the letters are right there, and I feel very valuable. But using these sources, Jesse was able to really find the consensus, that general experience that was that was a part of the LDS community during World War II. There were certain things that just, as I did these interviews, that just seemed to be common threads, and these are things that Jesse brought out, and those included supportive rationing programs, the belief that the United States would inevitably be victorious in this war, and just an overall feeling of patriotism and service and dedication to the war effort. And I did find that to be typical. In fact, very few people even moved off of those that general experience. And I, you know, even like she said, that this is not the final word on the home front experience, I think she really did capture those general experiences that could sum up the Mormon experience during that time. I, until today, had thought that eventually a book was going to be written out of this entire project. There's a lot that can be said about it, but I know that Jesse's planning on doing an article, and I do encourage that, and I feel she's well qualified for it. I really think this paper is a good foundation experience that could be brought into a much larger project that I feel would be quite interesting. This included the experience of the immigrants in the country, and she did touch on the Swiss and the German immigrants, but also the experience of Japanese American Latter-day Saints. Granted, it wasn't a large segment of the population. It's a segment that had a very interesting experience during the war. Also, the feelings of various soldiers and their feelings about the war, being out right out there in the front, how that had an effect on them and also the families. I also found that there were, as I said, there's that general experience that American Latter-day Saints felt during the war. There were also certain things that were somewhat divisive, I found, in doing these interviews. And these might be somewhat interesting to bring out. And this one point I found that was particularly divisive in certain families and wards was the draft between those who had close relatives who were drafted and those who had close relatives that were deferred. And like I said, that sometimes brought a little tension in the wards. It also brought tensions even within families. I found that within my own family and doing some interviews in my family, that there was certain guilt amongst some of my relatives because they didn't go to war. And for example, my grandfather did, and his brothers felt a bit of guilt and got very defensive when that topic was brought up. Another thing that was somewhat divisive within certain circles, and this is something that Jesse has done some research on, are the sometimes questioned loyalties of missionaries that had gone to Germany prior to the war and their sympathies. I think also that's a very interesting experience. But as I said before, this oral history project is still in process. The interviews are still being processed, and there's a lot more information that will come out. What Jesse's done now is a very strong paper, and I feel a great foundation for a much larger, more encompassing article that I look forward to seeing someday soon. So well done, Jesse.
No, I didn't, and I think that's a really interesting question, and I work for a Western Studies Center that focuses on the Intermountain West, so I have to sort of tie my projects into the center that I work for. The interviews, the one that I quoted from Willie Schmidt, was someone who had interviewed for another project and who had immigrated prior to the war. What I should do probably sometime, just as a family tribute, is that there's a man in Logan who fought for the Germans and went to a Russian prison camp and has that kind of experience. There are plenty of people that have that kind of experience in the area that really should be interviewed. Is a good point. I have a friend that's working on he's done, first of all, the conscientious objectors from World War One, and he's now going to be doing World War Two. So that's John Solito. He tells me there are some, but I haven't done the research on it. It wouldn't be directly church-related. It would just be that was their personal beliefs. There really hasn't been a whole lot about that, and that was even a problem during World War II as well, and it will become a greater problem since the church is spread out, but I don't know of anything that's been done on that particular topic, though it is a question that needs to be addressed. I know that particularly there are often stories about how German prisoners of war would be Mormon, and they would find out that someone else was a Latter-day Saint who was on the American side. They would ask for blessings and that kind of interaction. There was a bonding because they felt that they were members of the church. And I think it will become more complex in future wars. Excuse me? I think that someone with some of my back research there were many people who expected the millennium by the 1890s, and with the manifesto and other changes at the time, the millennium wasn't expected anymore. And so everything from the Spanish-American War, except with perhaps the exception of the Civil War, was seen as a just war, a way that the United States as a righteous nation had to do certain things. And I know that particularly in the research that I did was true of the Spanish-American War, for example. No, and that's that thesis that I mentioned that was done at Brigham Young University does do some of that, and look at each war and see how the views changed. It became smaller and smaller and smaller. It was. Those that were left out, that were out at the time of the war, stayed out. But as you got further along, they started calling older men, people who had been 70s. And even there were some, I know from reading my grandmother's letter, not from this, from fact, that there was also a limit of how many sister missionaries could be called, because my grandmother really wanted my Aunt Elsie to go on a mission. And she would keep talking to the bishop, and they'd say, well, no, the quota's full. So I think that I know for a fact there was a cutback out on men, and there probably weren't that many women, and the men that went out were often older, people that were not eligible for the draft.
Do you know if that there was some kind of
During the very early period, if you're already on a mission, or just as the war started, that was a way to sort of avoid military service, but only for a short period of time. My uncle was convinced that when he came back, he would be drafted, and he was correct. Yeah, there's no answer, but it's a very good question. Yeah. And there's some what Michael mentioned in his comments, and we unfortunately missed some of the people to interview. There were people who got agricultural deferments in a small agricultural community, say like Western Idaho, where my Aunt Elsie currently lives. This one man received an agricultural deferment. Other people who probably had as much right for an agricultural deferment were drafted. And this man felt completely ostracized by the entire community. He even stopped going to church because people kept saying, well, why aren't you in the military, even though he had been given a deferment. And it really created some division, some problems, because everyone would think that their work was essential for the war effort without having to go fight.
Matter of fact, the United
It seems like a simple question, and it's an extremely complex question. And I can't even think of a really good answer. Can someone help me? And that the United States had to be a nation where you could have freedom of religion, or the church would never have been organized, and therefore we must be Americans. And once it seems that once we no longer had those peculiar things like polygamy and own political parties, that Mormons became as American as American could be. Yeah, that happened with Mormons, because sometimes my sister keeps insisting that this. One of our former neighbors is in the CIA, and we have this sort of image of the CIA and the FBI. We form filled up with former missionaries who know the languages, and so we're the Americans of the Americans. And so there were lots of people that volunteered to go out to the Spanish-American War.
It almost seems like it's the 20th century.
I don't know of other people that fought for the South. I think that as any Southern sympathy would probably be more because of essentialism and not wanting the federal government to be so strong.
Mm-hmm.
And so they may they still have those kind of loyalties, split loyalties.
In the case of this man, his parents were Quakers from Canada.
So
and it was almost like a vengeance thing.
Yeah, he wasn't going against his the United States. He was going against his family. Yeah, he was a kind of a rebellious person. No, that is quite a ways away from the manifesto. It's in the 1870s. You still have all that other legislation passed, the Edmunds Act and the Edmunds-Tucker Act, which finally forced the hand. But yeah, it's the church really did believe, even I think up until the Edmunds-Tucker Act, and it looked like there was going to be further legislation that they could keep on practicing polygamy. And so the United States will have to do that, and the church may also feel a need to help in preventing repression. They're going to be tough questions. I think those are probably exceptions, and I think that my grandmother, because she got so defensive about the fact, I mean, she didn't drive to the South. She took the bus, and so there were still buses running. She figured, I'm not being unpatriotic because I'm going with public transportation. I'm not violating the rationing requirements. Some of the interviews we asked about black markets, and people actually got somewhat defensive in some of the interviews. Oh, no, we wouldn't have done that. Well, there were occasionally a store because we were a favored customer that they had something under the table for us, but no, we didn't do a black market. Excuse me? Oh, my grandmother's she grew up in Tennessee, but my grandmother was the genealogist of the world and traveled through Alabama and who knows where, all the places that she went, collecting family records, because that's where my Virginia, Alabama, North and South Carolina, she went everywhere to find genealogy records. There were Southerners that had joined in the church in the early days and then had migrated to Utah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. But there were still Southerners that joined. In fact, some of them brought some of their slaves to Utah. And right. Yeah. Now I think Paul Dunn's a unique story. I think maybe if his stories had been true, there wouldn't be any kinds of suggestions of that, of what based on what's happened. Well, thank you very much.